The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Wanna take a ride? Broadcasting from the sprawling outskirts of the Florida Everglades, in the intellectual wilderness of South Lauderdale, the outer regions of humanity that people move to just because it doesn't snow. This is the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right, welcome to it. Welcome to a Friday. Oh my goodness, with each week when we make it to a Friday, I get a bit verklempt. Because, you know, this is, I guess, all free time. I don't know. After all we've been through in the past 3 years. Wow, it looks like our audio stream is being a little finicky today, which kind of sucks because of what I want to play for you in a moment. So, you know what? Let me take a moment out to start, as we like to do, with a comedy bit to sort of prime the pump to get us, in a laughing mood, because, you know, things are going to get a bit crazy here. Hopefully this will work, because I see the video is frozen. So when I hit the new video, this is just one, you know, I like to play a comedy bit. This is amateur comedy. The video is frozen. I don't know why. Hopefully, we'll see if this works when I play this video. Otherwise, this is going to really suck today because our interview is on video. Anyway, let's play this clip and see if this video will play. Fingers crossed.
Is an orange white supremacist. Yes, he's a hateful, ignorant orange white supremacist.
This is working.
He has relations with his daughter. He has racist Twitter fodder, and he travels on a golf cart every day. He is a fake billionaire. Yes, he's a fake ass phony billionaire.
Okay.
He won't release his tax returns, and when he pees, it really burns. And yes, they took his phony charity away. I'm so disgusted with this situation. Nobody's doing anything to stop him. All of the Democrats and all of the Republicans should be ashamed to let this carry on. Tiny little hands. He picks on Mexicans and Muslims, but the Trump trash really love him, even though the Russians funded his campaign. He is the worst president. Yes, he's a worthless piece of human garbage president. He's doing shady shit with China. Mm-hmm. He grabs him by the giant.
Yep.
And the experts say he's clinically insane. Oh, he's a menace to society. A lying conman. Hateful, ignorant, orange, white supremacist.
Well done. Well done. I don't even have the guy's name in front of me. I'm so sorry. I will find it and I will post it on the blog today at NicoleSandler.com. For some reason, the live video is stuttering and stopping. But that's okay, because obviously the recorded videos are working. And there's a couple I want to share with you today. Now, I found, as I was doing show prep for today's show, I watched a video that I think just went online yesterday that was so brilliantly done, and I lamented that it's not going to work on radio because this video is so visual. What it is, it's a Bernie Sanders supporter who put together a video that juxtaposes the way the media has treated Senator Sanders, candidate Sanders, the things they've said about him, and with reality, with images and video what's actually real. So again, this will only work if you watch the video. So hopefully people have tuned in. Now, I did post And it will play on YouTube, even though obviously the live streaming of the camera looking at me is not working correctly today. The recorded videos that I have are apparently working. So hopefully this will work. For those of you listening on an audio stream only, I will do my best to provide the audio narrative to explain what's happening on the screen to counteract the bullshit narrative coming from the cable news pundits about this. So anyway, this video was produced by, a guy named Matt Orfalia. He is on Twitter, and his YouTube account is just ORF, and that's his Twitter handle as well. I already have the video posted at NicoleSandler.com/10-4-19. That's where today's show will be posted. But the video is there should you want to follow along. Or, of course, you can go to my YouTube channel, Nicole Sandler, or YouTube.com/NicoleSandler. We'll get you there. Either way, enjoy. The video is called Rising Up. Now, I also have to point out that Bernie Sanders' campaign was set to go live with a $1.3 million television buy in Iowa before he got sidelined by needing this stent insertion. And so they suspended the campaign for a week or two and suspended that commercial buy, which is a good thing because honestly, that ad sucked. It was your standard run-of-the-mill campaign ad. Didn't show what's special about Bernie in any way, shape, or form. This video does. Now, again, even if you're not a Bernie Sanders supporter, I urge you to watch this just so you'll see that what I and others of Bernie's fans and followers have been screaming about for years is true. The Bernie blackout exists, and the treatment of Bernie Sanders by the corporate media is abominable. And this video points it out beautifully in an uplifting and heartwarming and wonderful manner. So I hope you watch it, but if not, hopefully my description of what's going on the screen will suffice. All right, ready to go? And if you're watching the video, I don't believe if you're watching on our YouTube feed and you see the video, I don't think you're going to hear my voiceover. I think only the audio stream will hear it. I guess we'll find out either way. You ready? Again, this video is called Rise Up or Rising Up. Here we go.
Getting into the presidential race.
Democrats like somebody new, and that is not going to be Bernie Sanders this time.
It's really hard to imagine who the Bernie Sanders voter is.
So these are all the pundits.
Bernie Sanders, bad-mouthing
him.
Please get away from us.
Oh, shut up. Here's Addie Barkin.
Senator, great to see you.
Thank you for doing this.
He has a kind of gruff, curmudgeon-y side that is, of course, well known. He doesn't actually smile that much.
And video is showing Bernie smiling and laughing.
It's almost like Bernie can't tell the difference between kids and adults.
Oh, shut up, Trevor Noah. That's selectively edited. Here's the full clip.
I think you're dumb if you don't sit down and learn how to read and write. No, you were not born stupid. Come here. The only way I think you're dumb, I think when you think you're dumb. Because you're not.
I think you're disheveled, you're unlikable, and you're pushy, and I don't think you should be leading anybody.
How old is too old?
I think the issue is, do you seem like you're in the contemporary world? He's a socialist from the 1950s yelling at people.
Jennifer Rubin, never Trumper.
Without smiling, without any kind of personal connection.
And yet they keep showing shots at rallies. Lots of personal connections. Hugging supporters in crowded rallies.
And I don't think that's a good look for the Democratic Party.
And the video that's showing is a great look.
Sort of a not pro-woman candidate.
Hey, fuck you, Mimi Rocha. Lots of women in this crowd.
You may have heard the term Bernie bro.
Joy,
right?
Reid.
Somebody who's a bit younger, whiter, I think, than the overall.
This is, what's her name on CNN?
I'm with my magnificent vanilla brother named Bernie Sanders.
You go, Cornel West.
That's Brother Bernie Sanders we're talking about. That's Brother Bernie Sanders.
socialism has been a manifest
Rick,
disaster.
One of the right-wing never-Trumpers.
If I had known that I could come to Canada.
Alex Smith died after trying to ration a vial of insulin when he couldn't afford more. Mm.
So his idea about, you know, free health care, he has seen the manifest atrocities that have occurred under socialism.
$1,000 got me 6 months of insulin for my son. That's still less than what I paid a month in the United States.
Gloria Steinem has suggested that younger women are supporting Bernie Sanders so they can meet boys.
Oy.
Hello, Bernie.
We lost our condo, got foreclosed on because of my medical bills.
Like, I don't understand young women who support him.
Ugh,
I
trust Mimi Roca,
that Bernie Sanders is going to fight for health care and to lower prescription costs.
Of all the presidential candidates, you're the one that I trust.
Yep.
Thank you so much for what you're doing. You're just giving nothing.
And again, going against the narrative.
As mean.
No, he comes off as wonderful and humane. And caring, and it's showing the video. It's showing all these people who are thanking him for being so caring and wonderful.
Bernie Sanders makes my skin crawl.
You make my skin crawl, Mimi Roca.
What exactly it is?
Bernie Sanders has done nothing between 2016 and today.
Oh, shut up!
For everything you've done these last few years, you've helped to reset our political discourse, and are demanding that we center our politics around justice and equity. I am hopeful because right now, there is a mass movement of people from all over this country rising up.
And there are.
Thank you all very much.
Bernie.
It ain't Bernie. It is us.
It is us. Again, this video. Yeah, we will. Video produced by a man named Matt Orfalia.
You're being too vocal.
Hey, Bernie, you don't have to yell.
I don't feel I'm being vocal enough. We are not being vocal enough. When is enough enough?
He sounds very, very shouty.
Oh, shut up, Chris Eliza.
How many kids are going to have to make this sacrifice
and
die? How can you sleep at night knowing that kids can't afford insulin? How is that possible?
It's not right.
VoteForBernie.org is the URL given there. The music, by the way, they give credit to Thomas Newman, Randy Newman's brother, who does a lot of film scores. So Rising Up, Bernie 2020, the video is already embedded on a blog post at NicoleSandler.com/10-4-19, where today's show will be posted. It's there. Share it. I already have it on my Twitter feed. I have it on YouTube. Seeing it is so powerful. And I know this wasn't great radio, but it's something that needs to be seen because it verifies that everything we've been saying is true. The corporate media treatment of Bernie Sanders is horrendous, absolutely sickening. And this video showed it in all its glory and all its disgustingness. if that's a word. All right. So there's that. We're still having streaming problems on YouTube. I'm sorry for the jerky picture. Luckily, our interview today is something I recorded earlier this morning. But it is on video, but the videos that are recorded are playing well on YouTube. For some reason, the live video is not. Anyway, so that's coming up. We're going to talk about, believe it or not, abortion. And it is... There's a newsworthy angle on the story because today the Supreme Court announced that it would take up a case what's the case called? I have it written down somewhere here. The case is called June Medical Services versus G. And it's basically about Louisiana's abortion restrictions that would leave the state with, of course, just one abortion provider. We'll get into that in a bit with a woman named Jenny Brown, who's got a brand new book out entitled Without Apology, The Abortion Struggle Now. So we'll hear from her in a little bit. But first, as we are wont to do these days with so much rapidly changing news, let's get to what's news, shall we? I'll tell you what, we'll start with the recorded version just to take away the jerkiness of this video because it's annoying to me. And then I'll update you with what news has broken since. So take it away, Nicole.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
House investigators Thursday night released a tranche of text messages that show senior State Department officials coordinating with the Ukrainian president's top aide and Donald Trump's personal lawyer to leverage a potential summit between the heads of state. The texts clearly show quid pro quo, that the meeting would have depended on whether the Ukrainian president, Zelensky, promised to investigate the 2016 U.S. presidential election and an energy company that employed the son of 2020 Democratic candidate Joe Biden. Former U.S. ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, appeared on MSNBC shortly after the texts were made public Thursday night and explained how truly damning they are for the president.
We have a lot of information now that was just released about texts between Ambassador Volker, between our EU ambassador. Goodness knows why he is involved in any of this, by the way. And it is not just this phone call. We now know that they were prepping the phone call, and the quid pro quo is clear as day in these texts. The quid pro quo is not only do you need to open an investigation, Mr. Zelensky, but you need to put it on the record that you are going to do this investigation. Oh, and you need to also put it on the record that you are going to expose what Ukraine did in interfering in the 2016 elections. Extraordinary stuff that just dropped a few minutes ago. But it shows that it's a much bigger story. It wasn't just an off-the-cuff remark that the president, as he sometimes does, as you and I know, this was all calculated. And then the next day, we have a delegation there. Mr. Volker himself is in Ukraine to try to follow up on what the president said in that call.
The texts were provided to investigators by former special U.S. envoy to Ukraine, Kurt Volker, during a nearly 10-hour deposition on Thursday. The New York Times is reporting that Gordon Sondland, the U.S. ambassador to the EU, and Kurt Volker helped draft a statement for President Zelensky in August that would have committed Ukraine's new leader to pursuing investigations sought by Trump into his political rivals. But somehow, in the midst of all these revelations, Ukraine's current prosecutor on Friday said his office is going to review up to 15 cases that involve Burisma, the company that Joe Biden's son Hunter worked for. Now, Thursday provided a true moment of surrealism when, during the latest edition of Trump's Chopper Talk, the president finally answered the question posed to him repeatedly at Wednesday's press conference. What exactly did you want Zelensky to do regarding the Bidens? And, well, Trump did it again.
Well, I would think that if they were honest about it, they'd start a major investigation into the Bidens. It's a very simple answer. They should investigate the Bidens, because how does a company that's newly formed and all these companies, if you look at, and by the way, likewise, China should start an investigation into the Bidens, because what happened in China is just about as bad as what happened with Ukraine.
Yeah, you heard that. Donald Trump on Thursday urged another foreign government to probe former Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter, saying the Chinese government should look into Hunter Biden's involvement with an investment fund that raised money in the country. Now, keep in mind, Donald Trump has pushed the United States into a tense trade war with China. And those remarks, calling on China to investigate the Bidens, came just 30 seconds after he made these remarks regarding negotiations with Beijing on a possible trade agreement.
I have a lot of options on China, but if they don't do what we want, we have tremendous power.
Chinese officials will be in Washington next week in another attempt to revive talks. To further complicate matters, CNN is reporting that during a June 18th phone call with Xi, Trump not only raised Biden's political prospects, but those of Senator Elizabeth Warren as well, who by then had started rising in the polls. In that call, Trump also told Xi he'd remain quiet on Hong Kong protests as long as trade talks progressed. And the White House stored the record of that call in the highly secured electronic system where they stashed the now infamous July 25th call between Trump and Zelensky. Oh, what a tangled web they weave. Which brings us to Friday, a day sure to produce more bombshells, as the intelligence community's Inspector General, Michael Atkinson, appears before the House Intelligence Committee in a closed hearing. Friday is also the day that the State Department is required to officially respond to a subpoena from the key House committees for documents. Oh, and by the way, there's another whistleblower complaint of concern circulating on Capitol Hill. This one filed by an IRS official who reports that he was told that at least one Treasury Department political appointee attempted to improperly interfere with the annual audit of the president's or vice president's tax returns. Stay tuned. I got the news. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and The Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, which means I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com. Please click on that donate button. Yes, what she said. I'm back live. And let me add to that recorded report. Few other things. Let's see. Mitt Romney today actually showed a little bit of a spine. He became the first sitting Republican senator to blatantly call out Trump. And he did it in Trump's preferred language, Twitter. Mitt tweeting, quote, "By all appearances, the president's brazen and unprecedented appeal to China and to Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden is wrong and appalling. When the only American citizen President Trump singles out for China's investigation is his political opponent in the midst of the Democratic nomination process, it strains credulity to suggest that it is anything other than politically motivated." All right, Mitt. I'm expecting he's going to announce his candidacy any minute now. He should primary Trump because let's face it, Joe Walsh and, Bill Weld. And there's another one. There is a third. Sanford, Mark Sanford, the Appalachian Trail. None of them are going to really make a dent. Mitt Romney might. So anyway, so that happened. What else did I want to tell you about? I've got a few other stories that didn't make it. Oh, this Elizabeth Warren thing. Warren today, in response to the news that Donald Trump brought her up to China's President Xi and asked that he start fabricating bad information about her too, got her, ire raised, shall we say, from Common Dreams. Quote, "Senator Elizabeth Warren demanded the full transcript of Donald Trump's June phone call with Chinese President Xi Jinping following reports Thursday night that Trump raised the Massachusetts senator's political prospects during the conversation and vowed to stay silent on the ongoing anti-Beijing protests in Hong Kong." Quote, from Warren, "Trump can say what he wants about me, but it's outrageous that any president would sell out the people of Hong Kong behind closed doors." She continued, this was on Twitter, "The public must see the transcript of Trump's call with Xi, and we need a leader who will stand up for our values." Good for her. So that happened. Now, meanwhile, as candidates are releasing their quarter three fundraising hauls, we had heard from a lot of them, but not Warren until now. Here's where it stands. Bernie Sanders still led the Democratic field, raising $25.3 million in quarter three. Elizabeth Warren, whose campaign just announced her fundraising numbers in the last hour or so, places second with $24.6 million. So right behind Bernie, they're neck and neck, leading the rest of the field. Interesting, Joe Biden, Biden didn't even place third. Oh no, that would be Mayo Pete. Pete Buttigieg raised $19.1 million, which was a pretty big haul, but less than his quarter two take, just saying. Biden came in fourth at $15.2 million, followed by Kamala Harris, $11.6 million. Andrew Yang with $10 million, Cory Booker with $6 million, and Michael Bennett raising $2.1 million. And those are all the numbers we have right now. David Dayan, one of my favorite journalists and now the editor at American Prospect magazine, tweeted, Sanders and Warren doing no high-dollar fundraisers, no bundling, no rich donor glad handling, no pay-to-play politics, $50 million raised. Biden and Buttigieg finding every rich person in America and giving them an hors d'oeuvre, $34 million. Just saying. Don't listen to what the TV pundits are telling you. They are lying to you in the same way that Donald Trump lies to you. They have a vested interest here. They do not want Bernie Sanders to succeed. They will lie to you and tell you that he's not doing well and he needs to drop out. Au contraire, my friends. Au contraire. Again, I'll go to my preferences. I'll take Elizabeth Warren. I'll take Bernie Sanders. In an ideal world, it would be a Sanders-Warren ticket. Warren-Sanders, it would be a co-presidency. They'd work together and truly bring change to this country. I'm still not convinced that won't happen. All right. I know the live video is horrible. Thank you all for being here. Well, I'm going to go to our recorded interview, really, because if this will work, oh, shoot. My whole screen is screwing up now, too. Damn it, damn it, damn it. I apologize for the video today. I'm going to have to play this interview, the audio only. I'm going to put up the logo of the show on the YouTube screen just because the video is so annoying because it's so jerky today. Sorry, I tried to upgrade my streaming software, and we all know what happens when I try to do that. So let me tell you a little bit about our guest and why she's on the show today. This morning, as I mentioned before, the Supreme Court announced that, hold on, I got to bring over this interview so I can air it from here. Okay, so this morning, the Supreme Court announced that they will hear the case of June Medical Services versus G during this term of the Supreme Court, which officially gets underway on Monday. This case will review Louisiana's abortion restrictions and could leave the state with just one abortion provider in a case that gives the high court's new conservative majority a chance to redefine abortion rights. So this Louisiana law would require doctors who perform abortions to have admitting privileges to a nearby hospital. It's similar to a Texas law the Supreme Court struck down in 2016, finding that it posed an undue burden on a woman's constitutional rights to access an abortion. The decision to take the case means the Supreme Court will likely weigh in on abortion amidst a presidential campaign in which access to the procedure is already poised to be a top issue. The soonest the court will hear the case is, well, this fall, with a decision likely in the spring, you know, when they always announce the big decisions in June, right before the end of the session. So anyway, Jenny Brown's new book, Without Apology, The Abortion Struggle Now, just hit stores this week. And as I tell her, it's great timing. So let's see. Let's get Jenny on the line. Here we go. Joining me on the line now is Jenny Brown, whose new book, Without Apology, The Abortion Struggle Now, just hit stores this week. And Jenny, it's great timing because just this morning, the Supreme Court announced that they're going to hear the case of June Medical Services versus G this term. That's the Louisiana case that would require doctors who perform abortions to have admitting privileges to a nearby hospital. We've seen this movie before, but it's a law similar to the Texas law the Supreme Court struck down in 2016. But basically, this gives this new, very conservative Supreme Court a chance to once again weigh in on the abortion issue. So I guess thank you for having the book released this week. Because we need it.
Yeah, I think this whole last year, it would have been hard to not release it when something exciting or disastrous was happening around abortion.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, the book is important because it covers the history of the abortion, not only the abortion movement, but having access to a legal abortion in this country. I would think that a lot of women don't know, because frankly I didn't, that abortion was fully legal in the United States for a century until 1873. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, that history is very well hidden. So at the founding of the country, abortion was legal through quickening, which and they didn't even really think of it as abortion necessarily because there wasn't a pregnancy test at the time. But quickening is when you feel the fetus move around the fourth month. And that relied on the person who was pregnant to say that they had felt the fetus move. So essentially, you can say that abortion was legal pretty much for any abortion that people would want to get. So, and what happened is in the 1840s, the American Medical Association was newly formed, and the doctors were trying to establish themselves as a profession. And so through the 1840s, the 1860s, they campaigned against abortion. Essentially, they wanted, first of all, they wanted to put medicine on a more scientific basis, but they also wanted to put their competition out of business. And their competition consisted of nurse midwives who were the ones who were doing a lot of the primary care and in small towns and really everywhere. And were also providing abortions. They couldn't get the clergy or the newspapers to join them in this crusade against abortion, basically because the clergy thought it would annoy their congregations, and the newspapers were taking a lot of ads from abortion providers. Huh. So they, but they finally did get traction after the Civil War. And part of the reason was that it was no longer. Abortion was becoming a very common operation for married women who were trying to limit their family size. Previously, they were somewhat sympathetic to women who had, you know, gotten pregnant out of wedlock, and that could be really difficult for that person. So, but as they saw it really becoming something that was very standard for women to avoid the duties and responsibilities of married life, as one of them put it, and the birth rate was going down among native-born women, and increasingly there were a lot of immigrants, many of them Catholics, who were having lots of kids. So ironically, a lot of the anti-abortion sentiment was an anti-Catholic sentiment. They did crack down, and by 1873, when the Comstock Law goes through, a lot of states had already made abortion illegal, and with the Comstock Law, it's completely shut down any information about abortion, contraception, or sex. Really, was outlawed, and you couldn't, you know, you couldn't have a bookstore with a book which had a diagram of the reproductive tract.
Wow.
Of a female, for example, you would be shut down. So that complete freeze out of all that information.
So is it fair to say that before 1873, it's not so much that abortion was legal, it's just that there was no laws against it. It just hadn't been, it had been happening, but there was nothing on the books saying preventing it until that point when
There were laws, and they were mostly aimed at punishing people who harmed women by providing dangerous abortions and then killing somebody. You know, so if you were competent at providing abortions and your patients were fine, the law really didn't affect you. And so they were really sort of trying to keep quacks from killing women.
Gotcha.
And that was the sort of law that, and starting in the 1850s and the 1860s and 1870s, they started to really, state by state, they started to crack down. And then after the Comstock Law passed, many Comstock laws passed all over the country, banning doctors from discussing birth control with their patients.
Wow.
And this was very much, you know, a population growth concern and a particular focus on native-born population and Protestant at that time, because Catholics were regarded as these terrible alien invaders at that moment.
It's always religion, isn't it? Because fast forward to today. Well, before we get to today, let's talk about the 60s, because abortion remained illegal throughout the country until the women's liberation movement that sprung up in the 1960s began pushing back. Now, I don't know how old you are, but Jenny Brown, you seem too young to have been involved in the 1960s start of the women's liberation movement, but your bio is really impressive. It says you're a women's liberation organizer, former editor of Labor Notes. You were a leader in the grassroots campaign to make the morning after pill available over the counter. You were a plaintiff in the winning lawsuit. For 10 years, you're a fellow Floridian. You co-chaired the Alachua County Labor Party, organizing for national health insurance, the right to a job at a living wage, free higher education, and a working person's political party. I love this. Under the Labor Party slogan, the corporations have two parties. We need one of our own.
So, and we still do.
We still do. And that's a topic for another day, I suppose.
Right.
But you've been fighting this fight, it seems, your entire, I'm guessing, adult life, but probably even before you were an adult. Yes?
Yeah, I got involved very young. I mean, my first activity was actually in Florida trying to shut down the special session on abortion in 1989 the Supreme Court said states could make more restrictions, and Florida wanted to be the first one, and our Republican Governor Bob Martinez wanted to be the first one to do that, and we shut down the session. It closed a couple days early. We had 10,000 people invading the Capitol, and including invading the legislature. And so that was a very gratifying people's victory. And that sort of kept me going, thinking, okay, we can win this. And I still think we can win this. Well, what happened in the 60s, there was a sort of professional movement bumping along, trying to get exceptions to the abortion law through the 50s and 60s, because, of course, the carnage of the abortion law, there were all wards full of people who had tried to give themselves abortions or had gotten abortions from a quack and had gotten horrible infections and were hospitalized, and many died. So professionals who were dealing with those folks were obviously wanted some humanitarianism put into the law. But they bumped along trying to, you know, get exceptions for rape, incest, life of the mother, fetal deformity. Mm-hmm. And they did get a few states to make those exceptions, but that really didn't affect the mass of women who wanted abortions, because, of course, most people get abortions because they don't want to have a kid, not because of some tragic circumstance.
Right.
So when the women's liberation movement came along, they really changed the tenor of the whole movement. They demanded repeal of all abortion laws, get it out of the law. Why is there anything punitive about, and I think we still should have this position, why is there punishment for any kind of pregnancy outcome? It should not be treated by the criminal law.
Exactly.
And they were fighting on their own behalf. They did consciousness raising. They talked about their illegal abortions. They talked about the reasons that they had them. They saw that the laws that were proposed would not help them. And so they actually broke up reform hearings, you know, these sympathetic professionals who were trying to change the law slightly, and demanded repeal, which I think is an opposition that continues today, where we have people sort of backing down and saying, oh, well, what about rape and incest? What about the life of the mother? What about cancer? Rather than making a full-throated appeal that for women's freedom, we need absolute freedom on reproductive decisions, both to have kids and to not have kids. Because, of course, we also have in this country a very serious history of forced sterilization of poor women, women of color, particularly African Americans and Native people. So I think we need to make that, we need to get back to that basic demand, a repeal of all abortion laws. It should not be in the criminal code. There should not be restrictions on what medical personnel can provide it.
Mm-hmm.
Right now we see, for example, in Louisiana that admitting privileges, law goes on top of a law which says that only doctors can provide abortions. Well, 30% of abortions now that consists of handing you a pill.
Yeah, right.
And then telling you to go home and take a few more pills 24 hours later. That is not something that needs, you know, a midwife can do that. A nurse, it could even be over the counter at
sure.
this point. Some
That's right.
some obstetricians have been arguing. So all of these laws are designed to restrict the supply and make it easier to restrict the supply, which they've been doing. You know, and we also face in this country enormous costs for abortion, which when European countries following the United States Women's Liberation Movement legalized abortion in the early 70s, they just included it in their national health plan.
Right.
So there was never a question, can you afford to get an abortion? Whereas here, there's always been that question, can you afford to get an
right.
abortion?
You know, I was a kid in the 70s. I'm sure much older than you. And in high school in the 1970s. And I'm lucky, I guess, in that I've never been pregnant. So I never had to make that choice. But I remember in high school, there was a Planned Parenthood office really right across the street from, I grew up in Hollywood, Florida, from Hollywood Hills High School. That's where I got my first prescription for the birth control pill at the whopping age of 15. And I accompanied a dear friend of mine there when she had to have an abortion.
Yeah.
So I've experienced it from that. Again, I'm lucky, but I've learned that something like one in four women sometime during their childbearing years will make that choice to have an abortion. And I was involved in a very powerful moment. It was at Netroots Nation back in 2012 when Darcy Berner, who was at the time a candidate for Congress, tried an experiment. She was delivering a keynote speech in the big ballroom, and she asked women who were willing to, who'd ever have an abortion, if they were willing to basically come out of the closet and stand. And somewhere around 150 women stood. And
that's
then
so great.
It was
yeah,
amazing.
This is really important.
It really is.
Yeah. And we need to provide support for those who speak out and then experience repercussions. Amelia Bono of Shout Your Abortion, when she and Lindy West and Kim Morrison started that group, they got death threats. Some of them had to move out of their houses because of the intimidation. You know, so what we need to do is have like an organizational support structure for people who are speaking out and taking a stand, because you know we know that we get repercussions when we speak out, whether it's from our families or maybe from a job or rumors at our kids' kindergarten, whatever the things are. And we need to break through that stigma. The more and the more of us that are willing to take that step and talk about having had an abortion, the better off we are. And it's 30%. Usually people say one in three or
one in
three, four, because
right?
30% is in between.
Mm-hmm.
But it's 30%, so
wow.
It's not really an extraordinary situation or an emergency or anything that we should get. It's very normal.
Right,
it's
the
so
point
normal.
Was that it's nothing to be ashamed of. It is a safe, legal alternative to having to carry a pregnancy to term, an unwanted pregnancy to term. And then she asked of the other remaining a couple of thousand people in the room, who would be willing to stand with those women? And it was almost, you know, I mean, everyone stood, and it was a moment that was very powerful. A few people then applauded, which of course the right-wing media seized upon to say, oh, Netroots Nation, they cheered abortion. That's not what it was at all. It's supporting women who have taken advantage of the law to have a safe, legal abortion. And here we are today, again, with our abortion rights under siege. I used to think that the right used abortion as a wedge and fundraising issue. I honestly didn't believe that they'd ever follow through with trying to overturn Roe v. Wade because it was such a great fundraiser for them. Do you think that the religious, nuts, as I refer to them, have overtaking the Republican Party, pushed them further than many of them originally wanted to go?
Well, this is what we've always heard, right? That abortion is the issue that wedges Catholics in the Democratic Party away from the Democratic Party, and it's to fire up an evangelical religious base that's anti-abortion. But I tend to think that that story is is getting a little frayed. Yep. One thing that's happened in the United States is that our birth rate has gone down considerably below replacement levels. So it's now at 1.72 children on average per woman. The replacement level is 2.1. It's sort of stayed around replacement level, a little below it, through the 90s and early 2000s with the Great Recession, or whatever we're calling it, the economic crash. Mm-hmm. It went down and it has never come back up. They were expecting it to come back up. And the reason is it's so darn hard to have kids in the United States. We don't have any paid leave. Yep. The childcare situation is terrible.
The birth process is expensive. And then there's climate change, where I couldn't imagine bringing a child onto this planet now. I'm a parent by way of adoption, I should mention, and there's lots of children out there who need homes, so that's a way forward for those not wanting to bring a child into this world, and I understand there's a lot of people who feel that way, but this is off topic.
Yeah, I mean, what has happened is that as the U.S. birth rate has gone down, the establishment's gotten kind of panicked about it, and I detail some of this stuff in the book, where they're really demanding that we have more kids, but rather than making it easier by providing childcare
universal
national health care right? system, right, which would require taxing the rich and getting rid of the insurance companies, they have just made it harder for us to get abortion and contraception, and are hoping that the birth rate will rise as a result. But of course, people are resisting this, and so that's why we're seeing this low birth rate. You know, the big employers and economic planners are very worried that aspect of our growth, the growth of the economy, which is driven by the growth of population, is going to flag and will be like Japan, which had many years of economic stagnation, which some economists attribute to their low birth rate and their actual declining population now. So they have a declining population since 2011. Not just the growth rate declining, the population itself is actually declining. So that's, declining population is not a problem for the 99%, but it is a problem for people who are relying for their profits on growth in the economy. And so I think that's why we're seeing so much establishment support for limiting our reproductive rights. And we've also seen, these racist things coming out with, Trump asking, why can't more Norwegians immigrate to the United
right,
States?
Yes.
Why would they? They have national health care.
Uh-huh, exactly.
Happy
Free college. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's true.
And Steve King tweeting about we can't rebuild our population on someone else's babies. So we're seeing a lot of that happening. And I think it's all related.
Most definitely. Jenny Brown is our guest. The new book is called Without Apology, The Abortion Struggle Now. It just hit stores this week. Again, it provides a great historical perspective on abortion rights in this country, how they were taken away, and the fight to get them back. And here we are now in 2019. Jenny, I took great notice that you're also in Florida, where we still don't, we're one of the states that never ratified the Equal Rights Amendment. Perhaps if we had that, we'd have a better chance at retaining our right to choose.
Yeah, and that would be a better basis to be fighting for it than privacy, which was really invented by the Supreme Court to decide this the 1965 Griswold birth control case.
Right.
And then they sort of brought that forward into Roe. But right. I think it infects our political discourse about it, and we talk a lot about privacy when in fact we want to make our abortions as public as possible, so people who are scared will feel more it will break through the shame.
Right. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because again, most people don't realize that the abortion ruling Roe v. Wade was a Fourth Amendment privacy right thing. Wasn't about that we actually, women, have the right to choose what happens with our bodies, which again would make more sense, seemingly.
Yeah, and in fighting for birth control in the 20s and 30s, women did try to argue that it was a right to pursuit of happiness. They argued that it was part of the anti-slavery amendment. They tried other things, but nothing stuck. And what the court was willing to do basically left them in control of who can get abortions under what circumstances. And for the women's liberation movement, that was never the goal. The goal was always to have the control be completely in the hands of those who are pregnant. So that's really what we're, I think we should aim for now. And we shouldn't let the legal argument sort of get in the way of coming up with our political strategy.
So what is the strategy going forward now? Obviously, we mentioned at the top that today, Friday, the Supreme Court announced they would be hearing an abortion rights case this term. And the Supreme Court is newly top heavy with not only Republican appointed judges, justices, but really right-wing, horrible justices like Brett Kavanaugh. How do we fight back against this?
Well, I don't think we should despair, because let's remember that the Supreme Court, you know, everybody was against abortion in the 1960s, and the Supreme Court somehow found a way to make it legal. And the reason they did that was all of the ferment on the streets. Look, you had people doing underground abortions. You had clergy counseling for underground abortions and getting arrested for it. You had doctors openly doing abortions and getting arrested for it. You had women's liberationists marching in the streets demanding repeal of all laws. You had an enormous ferment around it. And that's really what we need to do today, is show that it will not work if they want to roll it back. Politically, it is going to be such a controversy that they just don't want to do it. So I think that's our role to, you know, because the court will follow where the people lead. That's our role, is to make as much hell as possible. And I think one of the things that we need to do is we need to start demanding that there be no laws. And really, next time we sue, let's sue on behalf of women's rights to be free. Let's let's not focus on the rights of doctors to practice. Let's focus on the women.
Yeah.
And so, and then the other thing I think that we need to think about is the abortion pill has made it's there's never been a better time to have a self-managed at-home abortion. The abortion pill has made that possible, and it is right now hidden behind this FDA regulation called REMS, which makes it very hard for people to get. It makes it very expensive. It requires things from clinics. Not any doctor can't just prescribe it the way they can prescribe other drugs. Mm. And REMS is used for dangerous drugs, like experimental drugs with cancer that might help but might kill you. And it's completely inappropriate for the abortion pill, which has been used here since 2000, and about 30% of abortions are done with it, and it has a very good safety record. So I think we need to fight to make that more available and go on the offensive, and we may have to do civil disobedience the way they did with the birth control pill, or with birth control, that was before the pill.
Mm-hmm.
We may need to really break some laws to try to make this happen. There's, there's a lawsuit right now to get the REMS off of the abortion pill, which would mean that any doctor could then prescribe it. So there are a lot of different angles that we can take that are more proactive and offensive than the ones where we just are constantly just marching on the Capitol and being defensive. I should also mention that there's an effort right now in New York. The Democratic Socialists of America have been discussing, what actions to take when the court considers one of these bills. Mm-hmm. And, massive action to, they think, a national strike of some kind. So these things are also in the offing. And I would urge people to join an organization. Don't just give money to Planned Parenthood and NARAL. Join a group that's doing stuff.
Right, and that was going to be my next question. Who is leading the charge? And I was going to mention Planned Parenthood and NARAL. Who is the best? Is there a central clearinghouse?
Their strategy, they're getting a little more militant as things have gotten so bad. Mm-hmm. But their general strategy has been lobbying and litigation, and then an occasional march. I think we need a lot more. And I don't think the lobbying is the effective method. Of course, we'll always have to do a little lobbying and litigation, but I think the main thing is for us to be organizing people to not be apologetic about abortion and get out on the streets and really have a fight that's on the basis of, for women to be free, we need to have control over our reproductive systems. And this, you know, this has to be the fight. It's, we can't sort of back down and say, oh, what about these tragic cases? We really have to talk about abortion on demand, and we should be demanding that it be in our national health system the way it is in so many other countries.
Absolutely. Jenny Brown, the book is, again, Without Apology, The Abortion Struggle Now. I noticed that this is the second book you've published in 2019. The first is Birth Strike. What's that about?
Birth Strike, The Hidden Fight Over Women's Work. It is about the what I mentioned with the birth rate going down and the struggle around having kids. There's a whole chapter of testimonies from people who have decided to either not have kids or stop at one because the conditions are so difficult. And I really go into the power structures, reasons for wanting more children, the arguments around Social Security, which, by the way, are completely bogus, but but are significant to them because they don't want to pay it. And some of the arguments around military recruitment. I go into depth into the different factions in the immigration fight, factions within the anti-immigration and Republican Party, and then there are pro-immigration Republicans. They're not pro-immigrant. They want to terrorize immigrants, but they do want them here.
Right. They want the labor. They want the cheap labor.
I go into all of that. So if people are more interested in getting more background on that, the Birth Strike book is where to go.
Awesome. Jenny Brown, it's so nice to talk with you, and nice to meet a fellow progressive activist feminist Floridian, because people can be quite apathetic down here. So thank you for that. Again, the book is Without Apology, The Abortion Struggle Now. It is one, shouldn't be one at this point in 2019, but it is. So we need to get in on the fight. And we need to pass the Equal Rights Amendment. Can we get on that to get Florida to come into the 21st century?
Right.
Please. Jenny Brown, thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks so much.
Just one more thing we need to work on. But I do fear that 2020 is the year that the Republicans will, it pains me to say this out loud, but it looks like they're going to do their damnedest to repeal Roe v. Wade. All the more reason we need to get them out of office and try to reverse the damage done in the last 3 years and then some. All right, we're quickly coming to the end of the hour. I have time to share with you one more story that just I found actually moments before hitting the air at defenseone.com. It's a I guess it's a website for people who work in national security. And the article is headlined, U.S. Customs Officer Harasses Defense One Journalist at Dulles Airport. And let me just read it to you. A passport screening official held a Defense One journalist's passport until he received an affirmative answer to this repeated question. You write propaganda, right? The incident took place about 4 p.m. on Thursday, yesterday, at Dulles International Airport. News editor Ben Watson was returning from an assignment in Denmark when he entered permanent resident reentry aisle number 17 at Dulles. After the Customs and Border Protection official asked the usual question about undeclared fruit or meat, the interaction took an unusual and unsettling turn. Watson recalls the conversation. CBP officer holding Watson's passport. What do you do? Watson, journalism. CBP officer, so you write propaganda, right? Watson, no. CBP officer, you're a journalist? Watson, yes. You write propaganda, right? Watson, no, I'm in journalism, covering national security and homeland security, and with many of the same skills I used in the U.S. Army as a public affairs officer. Some would argue that's propaganda. CBP officer again asks, you're a journalist? Watson says yes. CBP officer says, again, You write propaganda, right? Watson waited 5 seconds, then answered, quote, for the purposes of expediting this conversation, yes. CBP officer, a fourth time, says, you write propaganda, right? Watson again, quote, for the purposes of expediting this conversation, yes. CBP officer, here you go. At that point, the CBP officer handed back the passport. Thankfully, this journalist did file an ethics and standards of conduct complaint. To be continued. Unbelievable. This is our world today. We need to stand up and be united. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm headed over to the Brad blog for today's show. I'll see you back. I'll see you there. I'll see you in Monday for the Brad blog and back here Tuesday. As always, thank you for listening. Sorry about the technical problems today, but this too shall pass, we hope.